is 9:47, 9:47. Stay tuned for Asia Pacific Forum coming up in just a little bit. 99.5 FM right here in New York City.
That is the sound of Asian Dub Foundation, and that means you're tuned to another edition of Asia Pacific Forum, the weekly Pan-Asian radio hour here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and live on the web at WBAIfree.org. Tonight, Asia Pacific Forum brings you a two-part program. We're going to discuss, we're going to continue the series of conversations we've been having with people who are fighting for a progressive Pacifica network. Tonight we'll talk to Carol Spooner, one of the plaintiffs in a federal lawsuit on behalf of Pacifica listeners against the network's national board. And we'll be talking to Asian American political analysts about what our communities can expect from the incoming administration of George W. Bush. I'm Andy Hsiao, one of the members of the APF Collective.
And I'm Shamile Ahmad. Hi, Andy.
Hi.
Also with us in the studio is Aniruddha Das. Hi, Aniruddha.
Hi, everybody.
Later in the hour, we're going to be joined by one of Asian Americans' leading progressive political analysts, Phil Tejitsu Nash, and near the end of the hour by Rahul Mahajan of the University of Texas, who has been organizing around U.S. foreign policy towards Asia. We'll be talking about the proposed Bush cabinet, especially his Asian American nominees, proposed Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta, and proposed Labor Secretary Elaine Chao. We'll also talk about domestic and foreign policies we can expect from the Bush administration and the response of Asian Americans to the changes in Washington.
But first, we want to continue our series of discussions about Pacifica. Ever since the events of the Christmas weekend here at WBAI, we have been using this opportunity to examine the history of WBAI and Pacifica and to talk of the most constructive ways in which we can bring a positive, progressive, or even radical political vision back to Pacifica. I don't need to remind you of the dismaying sight of the current Pacifica National Board becoming more and more corporate, with board members like John Murdoch, who's an attorney with a union-busting law firm of Epstein, Becker & Green, or the former chair, Dr. Mary Frances Berry, a government representative, a Clinton appointee, to the Civil Rights Commission. Last week, we had historian Matthew Lazar describing the very different Pacifica National Board of 30 years ago, which actually fought the government and the Federal Communication Commission all the way to the Supreme Court on the matter of principle and of not allowing censorship at the station. Because of the way in which the National Board has changed its complexion since then, with people being brought in mainly for their personal loyalty to an individual like the then chair Mary Berry, rather than through political movements or through local representation, there is a sense now that the only way we can get back to the progressive vision of Pacifica is to bring legal challenges against the board, remove all the people who came in illegally, and start with a more clear-cut set of regulations. There are currently three separate lawsuits pending against the board. 3 weeks ago, we had David Adelson, chair of the local advisory board in Los Angeles, and Sam Husseini, chair of local advisory board in Washington, D.C., talking about a lawsuit that some members of the local advisory boards have brought against Pacifica National. Week before last, we had Rob Robinson, one of the dissident members of the Pacifica National Board, who, with Rabbi Krieger, has brought the director's lawsuit against the board. And incidentally, write to us or call us if you want tapes or transcripts of these earlier programs. We'll give you contact information later in the program. This week, we are going to continue to complete that cycle. We have on the line with us from California, from the listening area of KPFA, Carol Spooner, who has spearheaded the third lawsuit, the listener's lawsuit against the National Board. Carol, are you there?
I am. Good evening.
Good evening. Carol, could you describe the primary issues that lie behind the lawsuit in which you are the main plaintiff?
Yes. The primary issue, as you alluded to, is the change of the board over the past decade. We're alleging that there has been a breach of the Pacifica Charitable Trust, which is the founding purposes of Pacifica, and that the new board has diverted Pacifica from its mission, is carrying out a different agenda, and has taken Pacifica away from its founding vision. So that's one of the primary issues. Pacifica is under California law because it's a California nonprofit public benefit corporation. And under California law, you must file articles of incorporation that set out the purposes for which you're soliciting money from the public. And that's all you're allowed to do if you're a California nonprofit.
What were these founding principles, and in what way have they been abrogated?
Well, the founding purposes of Pacifica, we may all recall that Pacifica was founded by pacifists and war resistors shortly after World War II. They were interested in teaching peace through dialogue. And they set out a very beautiful set of purposes to foster greater understanding of the causes of conflict between people of all races, nations, creeds, and colors, and to bring to the public vital information from all sources not readily available elsewhere to help and bring about this understanding. And in addition, the founders were very interested in cultural benefits to the communities through local music and drama and cultural events. And they also specifically stated in the Articles of Incorporation that Pacifica should be as self-sustaining as possible. Lou Hill had been actively involved for a short time in commercial radio, and was well aware of the corrupting influences of money and selling time on the air, and wanted Pacifica to escape that, and he came up with a theory of listener sponsorship. KPFA in Berkeley was, in fact, the first listener-sponsored radio station in America. So those were the founding purposes. What we've seen, however, over the past decade is a move towards first, underwriting, corporate underwriting of programs on KPFT in Houston, shift to syndicated programming.
So could you describe that a bit? There are actually NPR-like corporate underwriting in KPFT?
KPFT in Houston was the first station that really went down a different path, and this began around 1990. They began broadcasting syndicated programs produced by PRI, Public Radio International, and there's a good deal of corporate underwriting of those programs. KPFT once broadcast, I believe, in 11 languages. They no longer do that. Now, fully one-third of their programming is actually purchased from Public Radio International.
Right. Yeah, KPFT was famous for having actually been bombed off the air.
That's right,
twice. The 70s by the KKK for their radical support of anti-racist programming.
Right. And exactly.
So now they have come to the point where 33% of their programming is Public Radio International, like NPR. They're broadcasting World Cafe and Fresh Air and other nationally
syndicated. This World.
rather.
And the rest of their programming is pretty much a jukebox. They build the station as the Sounds of Texas, and they do country western music. So that's Houston. And then also the Washington, D.C. station, that was next. They had a good deal of local public affairs programming that's no longer there. They don't have local news. During the protests this year in Washington, D.C., they didn't broadcast them. They are primarily a jazz archive. And so it goes. And over the past decade, we've been seeing...
And how about your own KPFA?
Well, at KPFA in 1995, we have had what we call the purge. And many of our old radical news commentary and opinion shows were taken off the air. And we were treated to, I don't want to be too critical, but the real critical political commentators have pretty much disappeared from KPFA as well. We get a lot of drive-time chatter at this point, nowhere near the kinds of really hard-hitting analysis that we used to get, with the one exception of Dennis Bernstein, who still does have flashpoints, and that's a wonderful program. So we've seen a big decline in the quality of our programming here at KPFA as well.
Right. In that context, something which is important to mention is that many of the changes in this programming were brought under the sort of guise or using the label of a better quality programming or more professional programming. But actually the people whom they get rid of or whom they attack while using this this pretext of more professional programming are people like Amy Goodman or Dan Coughlin or Verna Avery Brown, who in fact had the most professional, although radical or hard-hitting news and analysis programs. Now, in this, there's an interesting local thing which happened just yesterday. In fact, yesterday, I believe at 11 a.m., NWPFW, Scott Harris's regular program, I forget the name of the program, but it's a local equivalent of Democracy Now!, was to go on air in Washington, D.C. with a short segment about what is happening here at WBAI. Mm-hmm. There were interviews with Bernard White, Utrecht Lead, and Leslie Kagan, who is a member of the Pacifica National Board from New York. Well, Scott Harris was informed yesterday that his program was canceled, and Washington, D.C. listeners were treated to 2 hours of music instead. Now, this, ironically, is a replay of what happened about 2 years ago, because the slot that Scott Harris's program filled now, or I don't know if it still fills it, I don't know if he's going to be on next week, but that slot was the slot that FAIR's program Counterspin used to fill, that is Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's program Counterspin, and they were bumped off the air because they were reporting on what was happening at KPFA.
Yeah.
So this happened just yesterday, again, this exactly the same sort of censorship at WPFW, Washington, D.C. station, about events here in BAI, and really history is just repeating itself.
That's right. You know, Democracy Now! Was censored at Washington and Los Angeles stations when Amy reported on what was going on at KPFA in July of 99. That didn't get broadcast at several Pacifica stations.
What are the broader political landscape that lies behind this rightward drift in programming ethic and directives from the National Board?
Well, I think we need to see what's happening at Pacifica in the big, big picture. There's been consolidation of the commercial media. We're all aware of that. There are about five companies that own it all in this country at this point. The same pressures of consolidation are affecting public broadcasting as well. And we can talk a little bit about the political background of this. In 1994, the Gingrich Congress threatened to defund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And their whipping boy for justifying defunding was Pacifica Radio. Pacifica was denounced on the floors of Congress as being hate radio about that time. And there was a big political battle about whether or not the Corporation for Public Broadcasting would continue to receive public funds to distribute. In response to that, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting did two things. They appointed Robert Coonrod as their CEO, chief executive. Robert Coonrod's an interesting man. His background is with Radio Marti, the U.S. information agency. His background is in overseas propaganda, and he is now the most powerful person in public broadcasting because he distributes the CPB money. In addition to that, the CPB began changing their requirements for qualifying for CPB money. Used to be pretty much no strings attached. But the rules were changed, and radio stations were required to demonstrate certain Arbitron ratings in order to qualify. Arbitron ratings are a commercial measure. They're used to measure the audience for advertising purposes. But this standard was applied to public broadcasting stations in order to qualify for CPB money. And so a lot of consultants came in and said, how do you get your Arbitron ratings up? Well, you get it up by taking off controversial programming. Don't talk about police violence during breakfast.
Famously refers to a statement that Steve Yasko made. Now, what is his official designation?
Steve Yasko is the National Program Director for Pacifica.
Right.
He was hired about, September of last year.
So he, speaking about, was it Democracy Now!, said that he didn't want to hear about police brutality before breakfast.
That's right. But that's actually not a new comment. The consultant who's been advising Pacifica for several years, David Giovannone, also says the same thing. He says, well, if you want to get your audience totals up, don't bother them with all this disturbing political stuff. They don't want to hear that.
Right. We are speaking to Carol Spooner, who's a plaintiff in one of the three lawsuits, the listeners' lawsuit directed against Pacifica National Board. And Carol is speaking to us from California, from the listening region of KPFA. Could you describe one of something which epitomizes the way in which the National Board really rammed through a decision through non-democratic processes, the way they got the CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, to bring a negative ruling about local input?
Yes, I'd be very happy to. It's very interesting. Pacifica's bylaws have stated since 1984 that the National Board of Directors was to be elected by the local station boards. And when they began centralizing, they were running into opposition from local stations. And so the board began attempting over time to change the bylaws to make the National Board self-selecting. And time and again throughout the 90s, they would propose these bylaws amendments, and they wouldn't be able to get a majority to change the bylaws. So what happened was Lynn Chadwick, who was the executive director immediately preceding the current one, who's Bessie Wash, who had very close ties with the CPB. In fact, she was on the CPB committee that rewrote the funding criteria.
Lynn Chadwick was.
Yes, she was, and so was Pat Scott, who was the executive director before her, just incidentally. But at any rate, Lynn Chadwick telephoned Robert Coonrod and said, well...
Who was the head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
That's right. Said, we need some help here. Could you send us a letter telling our directors that they need to amend the bylaws? And Mr. Coonrod happily obliged, and he sent a letter saying, well, you're not permitted to have members of your national board and your local advisory board serving simultaneously on both boards. We think that's a violation of our rules. Now, that's a pretty questionable statement, but Lynn Chadwick presented this to the local, to the national board members and said, look, we've got to amend the bylaws. Still, there was rebellion. They weren't sure. All of the local advisory boards who had elected these directors instructed them, don't vote for this bylaws change. But they did anyway, because 4 days before the board meeting, Chadwick got nervous and called Rick Madden, who is the chair, is the head of the radio division, and said, well, I'm still not sure they're going to vote for it. So he sent her another letter saying, we're going to cut off your funding if you don't. So the national board voted to amend the bylaws to eliminate the rights of the local station boards to elect directors.
So because the Corporation for Public Broadcasting so obligingly provided this,
yes,
this supposed evidence that they had to go through. Yes, and this just to remind our listeners who heard the program last week with historian Matthew Lazar. No, this is such a complete change from the Pacifica National Board of, let's say, 10 to 15 years earlier, which fought the Federal Communications Commission and fought the Corporation for Public Broadcasting all the way to the Supreme Court on a matter of principle to defend WBAI against censorship from the FCC.
Exactly.
Right. So this comes to the question of why the lawsuits are necessary and why is it that at this point only the lawsuit will work?
Well, right now we have a self-selecting board. The board of directors selects new members and they are picking them quite clearly for their corporate backgrounds, not for their background in political movements or their background in the peace movement or even their background from coming out of the local stations and being involved in their local boards over the years. So unless we can change that, the board of directors will continue along the same path that it has. Now, it's important to know that under California law, which governs Pacifica, you cannot change the bylaws to eliminate anyone's right to elect directors.
Just to break in, Pacifica,
yes,
is a charitable organization registered in the state of California.
That's right.
So it is under California regulations, even though it actually escaped from Berkeley to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
In an attempt to
well, they moved
that.
Their headquarters to Washington, D.C. They're allowed to do that, but they're still governed by California law. But at any rate, under California law, which governs California nonprofits, you cannot amend the bylaws to take away the rights of anyone to elect directors without putting it to that group for their vote of approval. So this is where they've made a very fatal mistake. In those bylaws amendments that I just mentioned, where they took away the rights of the local station boards to elect directors, they never sent that bylaws amendment to the local station boards for their vote of approval. So it's our contention that the bylaws amendments are null and void, and that, in fact, the local station boards that are frequently referred to as local advisory boards or LABs or LABs still have the right to elect the directors. Also under California law, if you have the right to elect, you have the right to remove by a vote, majority vote. So we are asking the court to nullify the bylaws amendments and restore to the local boards their right to elect and to remove directors.
What standing do listeners have in this suit by virtue of being listeners?
Well, none. Very interesting. We don't have any standing.
But
it's very difficult to sue nonprofit corporations. You have to be a member or a director, and a member is someone who has the right to elect directors under California law. But also, the California Attorney General, who has the duty to oversee California nonprofits, has standing to sue. So what we did over a year ago was file a petition with the California Attorney General outlining the many outrages that were going on at Pacifica specifically, and particularly around the KPFA shutdown, which I'd like to tell you a little bit about, and also the illegal bylaws amendments, and said, look, Mr. Attorney General, something needs to be done. We'd like you to appoint us to sue, transfer your authority to us, and allow us to sue on behalf of the state of California. So we filed a petition. It was actually a very lengthy couple hundred pages of documents and legal briefs. And Pacifica filed an opposition, and we filed a rebuttal.
In opposition, incidentally, Pacifica were being represented by Epstein, Becker, and Green?
Not at that point.
Or not at that point.
Don Murdoch was not on the board yet. This was in the end of 1999. We filed our petition in November 99, and it was fully briefed at the end of January 2000. Murdoch was put on the board in February of 2000. So at any rate, there was this detailed briefing. The Attorney General looked into it. Meanwhile, the California State Legislature, incidentally, also held hearings on the Pacifica problems, and they issued a report in June, which I think helped to convince the Attorney General to grant a standing, which he did in September.
We have just a few minutes left, so we should sort of move along.
Mm-hmm.
What is the solution that you're proposing?
Well, we believe the bylaws must be amended to grant listener sponsors voting rights and membership status in Pacifica. We need to have an accountable organization so that this can never happen again. What we hope to accomplish is that the listener sponsors will elect the local boards, and the local boards as delegates of the listeners will elect the national board, and that everyone will be accountable, and if Pacifica goes astray again, we can remove them.
And what sort of a time frame are you looking at?
Well, we expect to get the issue of the bylaws amendment before the judge by this summer. The earlier the better. We will move as swiftly as possible.
Right. I'll end in just a couple of minutes by asking you for contact information. We are mm-hmm. listening to Carol Spooner, who's the spearhead behind the listeners' lawsuit, one of three lawsuits that are currently being brought against Pacifica National Board, and which is therefore the segue into saying this is one of three lawsuits. And just to remind the listeners, the other two lawsuits are one which was brought by the local advisory boards. We had a discussion with David Adelson and Sam Husseini about 3 weeks ago. And their lawsuit is, in a sense, the furthest along because they were filed the first. And they are actually in the process of discovery. They are deposing Mary Frances Berry, the former executive director, former chair, this Monday. Then there is the director's lawsuit, that is two dissident members of Pacifica National Board, Rob Robinson and Rabbi Krieger, who have their separate lawsuit against the board. And being directors, their legal standing is, of course, unquestionable at a certain level, and they have access to various records, financial and other information, which would be extremely important to all three lawsuits. And then there is the listeners' lawsuit, which you have been talking about mm-hmm. so far. And also, three suits have in common, as I understand, this rights to removing the illegally brought in directors, which is something which you unearthed the way you described it.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Right.
All three lawsuits have the illegal bylaws amendments in them, and that's central to all of them. We do expect the California Superior Court to consolidate the three cases so that overlapping issues are decided together. That will happen very shortly.
Right. Well, the best thing we can do is to leave listeners with information about what they can do and where they can get in touch with you. Mm-hmm. So, Carol?
One thing I'd like is for all of the WBAI listeners out there to go to the web and print a declaration form in support of the listeners' lawsuit. We have about 3,400 of them. We'd like 5,000. You can get to our website by going to the web address of the WBAI listeners group. I'll let you give that address, Anuruddha. You could also call me at area code 707-526-2867 or email me at wildrose, like the flower, at PON.net. wildrose@PON.net.
And the other website information which you should also listen to is www.savewbai.tau.ca. That is www.savewbai.tau.ca. That has links to various other sites, including your site, including Radio for All, and the appeal for the joint funds, and analysis of all three suits by a member of the
National Lawyers Guild.
Mm-hmm. And if you've missed any of this information, call me at 212-888-7108. That's 212-888-7108. Or write to AP Forum, APFORUM, at egroups.com. Well, thank you very much, Carol.
Thanks so much for having me.
Carol Spooner is the spearhead behind the listeners' lawsuit, one of three lawsuits that are currently against the Pacifica National Board. And if you have any further, this really brings us to the end of the cycle of...
You know, Anuruddha?
Yes?
I'm sorry, I forgot to give the name of our organization. It's the Committee to Remove the Pacifica Board. That's the link you're looking for to get to our webpage.
Committee, could you repeat that?
The Committee to Remove the Pacifica Board.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Carol Spooner, for describing the lawsuit and the links with the history of Pacifica National Board and what can be done about it. And as I said, this completes our cycle, a current cycle of using this opportunity that's been opened up to really look forward and think of the most progressive way in which we can bring back a radical political vision to WBAI. So when we come back, we are going to take a very short break. When we come back, we will turn to a rather different but actually not very unconnected point, the current rightward drift in national politics and how various Asian political groups and individuals are reacting to it. So stay tuned. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. This is Asia Pacific Forum.
I know the world today's a flame, that's why we can't display your name. Cause surfaces, snakes lurking in lakes, watch them play this game with ease. You're not ashamed to tease, I bet you aim to freeze. I don't catch the fame disease, won't let you claim MCs on their knees. Claiming triple with aches, but I came to triple the stakes. Raise the pots and blaze the spot, blame the fickle and fakes. For the same simple mistakes, being committed. Seeing dim-witted fools getting schooled, they can't even admit it. Cool, tools of the trade, no tricks or illusions used to invade. Lyrics cause contusion, bruising brigades and clicks to diffusion. No intrusion, cause they converted the dough, undeservedly so, thus we reverted the flow.
Okay, welcome back to Asia Pacific Forum on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. We had an interesting conversation with Carol Spooner about Pacifica, and now we're going to turn our attention to the incoming administration of George W. Bush and what it holds for Asian Americans. You're listening again to Asia Pacific Forum. I'm Andy Hsiao, and I'm joined by my fellow APF Collective members, Aniruddha Das and Shamail Ahmed. We're going to be joined now by our longtime friend, Phil Tejitsu Nash. He's one of Asian America's leading progressive political analysts, a longtime friend of our program. Phil was the founding executive director of the National Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium. He's a columnist for Asian Week and is the CEO of the political consultancy Campaign Advantage, which has done work for Ralph Nader, Richard Gephardt, other leading progressive political figures. He also has a book out called Winning Campaigns Online. Hi, Phil, are you there?
Yeah, here I am.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So today, Phil, was a big day on Capitol Hill. There were a lot of confirmation hearings, a number of them, for George Bush's cabinet nominees, the most notorious being John Ashcroft.
Right.
You know, it's been widely reported that Bush has nominated possibly the most diverse cabinet ever. And certainly the cabinet at least appears to hold a bonanza for Asian Americans in that two Asian Americans, Norman Mineta and Elaine Chao, have been nominated for cabinet posts. Mineta for Secretary of Transportation and Chao as Linda Chavez's replacement at the Department of Labor.
Right.
So, you know, maybe we could begin by talking specifically about these two. Mineta was the first Asian American cabinet appointee when Clinton named him Secretary of Commerce in
right.
the waning days of his administration. He's going to be the Democrat in Bush's cabinet now.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, Norm Mineta is an interesting figure because he, you know, was in the camps when he was a younger person, and he came out and he has been very active in progressive issues over the years. He was a councilman in San Jose, went on to become mayor, and then was elected as a congressman there for, I think, 24 years until he finally came out and left to work for a big company here in Washington, and then was tapped to be the first Asian-American cabinet member. The thing that's interesting, though, is a lot of us have been pushing President Clinton to appoint an Asian-American a lot earlier. And, in fact, there were several people whose names were thrown around back in 96, and none of those materialized until the end of the term. Interestingly, President Clinton is also pushing for various progressive reforms through executive orders at the end of his term here. And I heard one of my progressive colleagues saying, well, where were you, you know, 4 or 8 years ago to push for some of these things? All of a sudden you're doing something that can be overturned by the Bush administration. But getting back to Norm Mineta, he's been quite an extraordinary person. He's been very good on a number of issues, on affirmative action and immigration issues. And he was getting ready to turn in the keys for the Commerce Department and just go into retirement or something else. And what happened was Bush had to fulfill a promise to put a Democrat in among his various people. He didn't want a progressive or a Democrat in any of the key positions dealing with health and human service issues or housing or justice. So he was hoping to appoint somebody to one of the other places where they could be kept off on the sidelines.
Hmm.
Now, Mineta is going into transportation. He is a nationally recognized expert on transportation, both through his work in Congress and his work in the private sector. And so he really is a good person. He's not a person who's going to just go in and sit in the chair. He has some good ideas. He's telling us that there is no Republican or Democratic asphalt. There is no Republican or Democratic, you know, airplanes. That's not entirely true because the transportation world is full of pork barrel projects. It's full of places where people, you know, Democratic and Republican initiatives take place, also the hiring of people to work on various projects, the hiring of contractors, the famous Adoran decision that came out recently. You know, there's a number of ways in which affirmative action and hiring and other things impact on transportation projects. So Mineta can have a role there. At the same time, like I said, he's not in the thick of things at dealing with welfare reform or something else the way that Tommy Thompson will be, who's been designated to take over that position.
Mm-hmm.
But so the other thing is that Mineta also is very well known to Andy Card, who's coming in as Bush's White House leader. And he's coming in also as somebody who's well known for playing both sides of the aisle. He's very good at working with people, Republican, Democratic, Independent. So I think he'll do fairly well there, and the question is going to be how much can he influence the Bush administration, and then conversely, how much will working for the Bush administration affect him?
Sure.
So we all have to keep our eyes out on that.
Well, I mean, speaking of affirmative action, that's a segue into the other nominee, Elaine Chao.
Right.
You know, who's famously opposed to affirmative action and now stands to be the Labor Department Secretary. What can you say about her?
Well, I mean, this is another example of you know, people who say, I don't need affirmative action, but excuse me, without affirmative action, you wouldn't have been considered. She has good credentials. She went to Mount Holyoke College, got an economics degree, worked at the White House as a fellow, and then got an MBA at Harvard. She is a very nice person. And again, this is You know, the problem with a lot of people who are very conservative, they are nice people, friendly to talk to. I hear that Ronald Reagan was a friendly, nice person, too. But the point is, her politics are very, very, very conservative. And just looking at some of the places that she's been, the people that she's kept company with, she is working at the Heritage Foundation, a place founded by Joseph Coors back in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
She has been on the board. Well, the people on the board have included Jeb Bush, the brother of the president-elect, Amway's founder, Jay Van Andel, Richard Caafi, William Simon, a lot of very well-known right-wing people. It's a think tank that has had a tremendous impact on American thought, just the way the American Enterprise Institute, the Manhattan Institute. The right wing has done a lot better than the left wing, frankly, at helping to shape public opinion. There are groups like FAIR and Pacifica and others that are doing their best, but, you know, these people are well-funded, and they've got people like Dinesh D'Souza who have research assistants and who sit there and every day they call the media and say, here's my opinion about something. And as you well know, it's hard sometimes as a reporter to have the time to do all your research. And so somebody calls you and says, let me give you my opinion. Well, you know, there's a better chance than not that you'll put them in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, look who's on the talk shows. Look who's putting out the op-ed pieces in the papers we read. It's these right-wing people, you know. And anyway, so Elaine Chao has been part of that. She has also been part of a group like the Initiative on Race and Ethnicity that was founded back in 1998 by, guess who, Ward Connerly, Linda Chavez, Shelby Steele, Clint Bullock, a number of very, very right-wing ideologues. And she herself has been opposed to affirmative action. She's another one of these poster children from the model minority thesis. Saying, you know, of course, hard work and determination and putting your nose to the grindstone will get you where you need to go. Well, excuse me, what happened to all those Chinese laundry workers over the past, 150 mm-hmm. years ago? What happened to a lot of our grandparents and parents and even some of ourselves as younger people? How are we going to deal with a lot of this discrimination without the assistance of affirmative action? But anyway, she's going to be in there, and my feeling is that as a person who will have a lot more visibility, she'll be speaking to a lot of younger Asian Americans, and she will help to make Asian Americans see themselves more as people who are the model minority and who are opposed to affirmative action. And it's going to make the job of those of us who are progressive that much more difficult.
Seems ironic to me, considering that you see this ascendancy now of Asian American conservatives like Chao, just as our communities seem to be turning to the left. There was a lot of evidence from this last election that Asian Americans swung to the left, voted for Democrats in the largest numbers ever.
Oh, it's really amazing. I mean, if you look at the numbers, she claims to be speaking as an Asian American, but she has not been that active in our community. And if you look at the numbers themselves, on a nationwide basis, the New York Times said that the Asian Americans supported the Democrats 31% in 92, 43% in 96, and up to 54% this past election. And meanwhile, the Democrats were going from 55% in 92 down to 48% in 96 to 41% in the last election. So that means 54 to 41 Democrats were favored. In California, the Asian Pacific American Legal Center of Southern California did a poll and found that the Democratic vote went from about 36% in 96 up to 62% in 2000. And in San Francisco, the Chinese American Voter Education Committee found an 82 to 16% preference for Democrats over Republicans. In New York, as you probably know, the Asian American Legal Defense Fund has done a study along with a number of other groups, and they found that Democrats were, I think it was 60% this year, as opposed to 14% for Republicans, with the rest being independents. Hillary won, I think, 82% of the vote for Senate. Gore won something like 78% of the vote. So the Democratic tilt has been very strong, and it's grown recently. And don't forget, there's also Asian Americans who are working for Green and other progressive parties to the left of the Democratic Party. So I would say that as a group, Asian Americans have become much more progressive, and Chao is going to set that back.
Well, then, you know, one of the things that occurs to me is that this has sort of put a lot of Asian American organizations into a tough spot. I mean, I noticed that the Japanese American Citizens League and the Organization of Chinese Americans all more or less endorsed the nomination of Chow.
Well, so, it's interesting, very, very interesting. If you look at their press releases carefully, all the groups were just crowing over themselves about Mineta.
Right.
The wording of the press releases related to Chow were a lot more guarded. They would say, think that we congratulate her. You're not saying it's good for us, saying it's good for her. And, you know, look at the wording. I don't have it right in front of me here, but I was just amazed looking at it, comparing the two, particularly because just a few days before, virtually all of the Asian American groups came out against Ashcroft, citing his opposition to Bill Lan Lee, his opposition to the hate crimes bill, the employment bill. There's been a number of bills that have come down where he has been very, very bad on the issue, not just passively voting no, but being an outspoken opponent. And it's ironic that a lot of the statements that were read by Democratic senators yesterday and today mentioned Bill Lan Lee and mentioned in particular the words about Bill Lee being an advocate.
Right.
Bill Lee, you know, he's too much of an advocate to be an impartial administrator. Well, excuse me, you can say the same thing about Ashcroft.
Sure.
So I don't know if it's enough to overturn the Ashcroft nomination, but at least it does provide a bit of irony.
You know, Phil, we're running out of time, unfortunately. There's so much more we could talk about, and we probably should come back to this topic after the new administration is set. Maybe if you have a closing thought for us about how Asian American progressives should respond to this new administration.
Well, as with all things, remain vigilant, look for hypocrisy, and keep on fighting.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot. We've been talking to Phil Tejitsu-Nash, one of Asian America's leading progressive political analysts. And we're going to take a short break. Okay, let's just move on. We're going to talk about another aspect now of the Bush administration and Asian Americans, and that's the Bush foreign policy, what we can expect there. Shamil?
This Saturday, January 20th, activists from all around the country will be convening in Washington, D.C. and other cities protesting George Bush's inauguration. One of the main organizers of these protests is the International Action Center. I have in front of me a list that the International Action Center put out on reasons to protest the inauguration. Among these reasons is the sanctions on Iraq. On the phone with us today is Rahul Mahajan from the University of Texas at Austin. Rahul Mahajan is a doctoral candidate and progressive activist in Austin, Texas. He has spent the last 7 years working on a variety of issues, but focusing on U.S. foreign policy. Hi, Rahul.
Hi.
Now, Rahul, what makes you think that Bush's policies towards the sanctions will be any different from Clinton, whose bombardment of Iraq, Sudan, Afghanistan were especially harsh? Clinton clearly continued the war on Iraq by continuing to impose these sanctions, even after much international pressure.
Well, I think that what you have to start with whenever you're talking about U.S. foreign policy is that there's very little difference between Democrats and Republicans on any of the major issues.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think the theme here is that Bush is going to continue with things that Clinton has started and perhaps intensify and make them worse in some minor ways. The major problem, which is that the sanctions are starving the people of Iraq, especially the children, more than half a million of whom have died in the last 10 years, that will continue under Bush. However, what may be changing is that in the last couple of years, ever since the Desert Fox campaign of December 1998, the U.S. has been losing international support for the sanctions. In fact, there's been a real crisis of the so-called legitimacy of the U.S. lead on foreign policy, starting with Desert Fox and then continuing with the Kosovo War, where there was a complete end run about the around the Security Council, which has naturally upset countries like France, China, and Russia, which are permanent members. So, in order to alleviate, to deal with the increasing international pressure to lift the sanctions, Clinton has been gradually allowing them to ease. For example, there used to be a cap on the limit, a limit on how much oil Iraq could sell. That cap has now been lifted. Iraq can sell as much oil as it can pump. There used to be extremely stringent requirements for any contract, any if Iraq wanted to buy any goods from a foreign country, including especially medicines, there was a very detailed and long and complicated application process they had to go through, at any stage of which any country on the sanctions committee, the UN sanctions committee, could block that. Now there's been some expediting of those contracts, and basic medicines are flowing in more easily. Similarly, Clinton has allowed Iraq to spend more money on fixing its oil pumping equipment so they can actually pump a larger amount of oil and gain more money for food and medicine. These things, I'm concerned, George Bush in the first presidential debate said very clearly he thinks that the sanctions are, quote, not working, they're being violated, which is really nonsense. The amount of smuggling goes on is terribly small. It amounts to less than $500 million a year, which doesn't really affect Iraq in any way. Mm-hmm. But he said very clearly he wants tighter sanctions on Iraq.
Well, you've got Bush saying that, and you've got Bush's new cabinet also. You see a lot of the usual suspects, like with George Bush Sr.'s cabinet also. You've got Colin Powell, who's now up for Secretary of State. We've got Dick Cheney, who's now the Vice President, former Secretary of Defense. How would this Bush's cabinet affect these sanctions?
Well, I think it's very clearly a bad sign. I mean, Dick Cheney, as has been pointed out, is a dyed-in-the-wool conservative on almost every issue. Cheney and Powell are major parts of the team that gave us the Gulf War and then the sanctions, which is to say, very briefly, they're primary architects of this last past 10-year destruction of Iraq. Anything that involves their coming back in is obviously not a good thing. They have Colin Powell in particular has in public appearances been saber-rattling on Iraq. He's been, ever since December 1998, the bombing, the U.S. pulled out weapons inspectors, so there haven't been weapons inspectors in Iraq for the past 2 years. So Colin Powell has been making the rounds saying that there are disturbing reports that Iraq is resuming weapon-making activity and suggesting that perhaps there will be another bombing offensive, something like the Desert Fox campaign. I think that's another danger with the Bush administration.
Talk about the Desert Fox campaign in more detail. Do you see an intensification of it?
Well, what happened was basically there were claims that Iraq was not fully complying with the weapons inspectors, although if you look in detail at the claims, the incidents of noncompliance were extremely minor. Because of that, in November 1998, Clinton started moving towards building up a campaign to bomb Iraq, which he actually aborted only at the last minute when Iraq decided to give in on a few of the key sticking points. Later in December, Clinton pulled out the UNSCOM inspectors. That's the UN Special Commission, which was charged with weapons inspection. There was an intensive bombardment over 4 days of Iraq, involving, for example, the firing of over 400 cruise missiles. The likely death toll is a few thousand, but there was also continuing deaths from the destruction of infrastructure caused then. Furthermore, since that time, there's been, starting with almost daily and now it's sort of almost weekly, bombing of Iraq by planes that are patrolling the so-called no-fly zones. These no-fly zones are a naked exertion of imperial power. They have absolutely no international sanction whatsoever. It's just the United States and Britain essentially bombing Iraq when they feel like. This is the kind of thing that could happen again. It could certainly set back any efforts that Iraq has been making towards reconstruction.
And what kinds of effects would this have on other Asian countries? Would Bush see other Asian countries as strategy points for his campaign?
Well, there's also there's a lot of direct concerns about other Asian countries. For example, there's been a lot of saber rattling on China that's been going on for the last couple of years. As far as the effects on Iraq, well, basically anything that keeps the sanctions tighter helps to keep oil prices higher, and this is obviously tremendously going to hurt Asian countries, especially the poorer ones like India.
I'm sorry, Rahul, we're going to probably have to wrap it up. It's 9:55. Do you have any closing remarks or any articles you want to refer people to?
Well, yes. On the sanctions, I'd like to say that this is a particularly crucial time. We've now gotten a tremendous amount of publicity in the mainstream and other kinds of media. If you go on the web, there's an incredible amount of information about the sanctions and what's going on. There's been a growing movement in this country which is now gelling. We had a national conference in October of 1999. We're having another national conference coming up in February. This is a time when we're really planning to build a very coherent national network for people fighting the sanctions. Anyone who wants information on that can go to www.ccmep.org. That's the website of the Colorado Campaign for Middle East Peace. And I think that conference is going to be a major development in anti-sanctions work and in perhaps anti-U.S. foreign policy work in general.
Rahul, could you repeat that URL address?
Sure. That's www.ccmep.org.
Okay. Thank you, Rahul, for coming on. For more information on the protest, the inauguration protest, you can contact Tim Hopkins at timhopkins49@hotmail.com. or at 336-275-8060. Also, tomorrow evening, Thursday, January 18th, is the 30th anniversary celebration of Project REACH, a multiracial, multicultural youth empowerment crisis intervention center. Project REACH will be honoring many of the people who worked and supported the group. It'll be at the Artist Space at 38 Green Street, between Grand and Broome Street, the third floor. To get there, take the N or the R or 6 to Canal, walk west to Green and north to Grand Street. For more information, contact Steve Yip at yipsy@arrows.com. That's it for tonight. Thanks for our guests Carol Spooner, Phil Tajitsu Nash, and Rahul Mahajan. I'm Shamayal Ahmad, one of the members of the Asia Pacific Forum Collective. I was joined tonight by Aniruddha Das and Andy Shao of the Collective. The other members of the APF Collective include John Cho, Jesse Haiwa, Satinder Jawanda, Chandana Mathur, Vanita Srivastava, Sybil Wang, and Telly Wang. You can reach us at 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005. Call us at 212-209-2991 or email us at apforum@egroups.com. Remember to tune in each Wednesday night at 9 for another edition of APF. Good night and stay tuned for Cat Radio Cafe. For updates and info on WBAI, call the hotline number 718-707-7189 or contact www.savewbai.tao.ca.
That hotline number again is 718-707-7189. Thank you to all our listeners for tuning in, and stay tuned for Cat Radio Cafe.
This is WBAI New York. Stay tuned for Cat Radio Cafe.